This episode is supported in part by the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans, advocating for healthy communities and a sustainable Gulf Coast.
Just Transition is very simple, really, at its core. It is about having people at the table.
Welcome to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform, with your host, Rob Virchik.
Hi, everyone. I'm wondering how you would connect the dots between these news stories that I've just recently seen. So, a 2019 climate action law in Germany that won the support of coal miners around the country, even though it's going to put them out of business in 20 years. An agreement between Danish pension funds and New York workers to fund offshore wind projects in the Atlantic. And of course, that new proposal by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey, the everything plus the carbon sink, Green New Deal. Well, all of these things, it turns out, are related to what's called the Just Transition. You may have heard about the Green Transition. That's the effort to wean the planet off of fossil fuels to avoid the worst of climate change. The Just Transition is an effort to make sure that process is fair. To make sense of this today, I am super happy to have Sharon Burrow on our program. She is the General Secretary of the International Trade Union Confederation and a former president of the Australian Council of Trade Unions. I recently caught up with Sharon Burrow at her offices in Brussels. I was still at home in New Orleans. We talked by Skype. Sharon Burrow, welcome to Connect the Dots. Germany recently announced an initiative to wean itself off of coal in 20 years. In a crucial point, it was designed in a way to draw the support of a coal mining union as well as environmentalists. Why was that important?
Well, if you don't have the trust of the people, you will not have the pathway that allows you to get to the ambition. Because when people are frightened, even if intellectually they know that we have to move on from coal, we have to move on from fossil fuels, we have to, in fact, transition in every industry. But if people are frightened about their jobs, their livelihoods, their families, jobs for their kids, their communities, then they're going to fight for security. Now, if you can involve them through their unions and with the confidence that they will have that security in transition, then you will get to the point you need to get to because everybody is part of the agreement and therefore part of the implementation. Just Transition is very simple, really, at its core. It is about having people at the table, making sure that in the case of workers, that their pensions are protected, where it's older workers, that for younger workers, they have an income while they have skills support and redeployment to actually make it possible for them to see a future. And of course, for communities, then you need to know that there is investment in community renewal. So there's an opportunity for new jobs, but also, of course, for their children and their grandchildren, and that community will live on into the future of the history of the nation.
What was the agreement that was reached in this particular situation in Germany that allowed the coal mining union to feel comfortable with this movement away from coal consumption in Germany?
Well, comfortable is a big word, but to get people to get people to agree to actually effectively give up their working lives in the coal industry and to move on to something else, then those measures are essential and they're all in the agreement. We know, of course, that 38 is a little bit long in the tail in terms of the science targets, but we also know that to get the agreement to move is fundamental. And if, in fact, we have the confidence that workers are being looked after, that there's a community process in place, that opportunities are there, then we'll probably see that shift become even quicker. But the guarantee for that 20 years is critical for people to know and to have certainty. I worked with a small country town in Australia called Port Augusta. And the community were ahead of the game. They knew that with two coal-fired power stations that largely provided a core of employment, even though Port Augusta was in fact a gateway to the outback, so it's a tourist town and a hinterland community. But nevertheless, those two coal-fired power stations, particularly the larger one, were the core of employment. So the community actually did its own feasibility work, and it decided that to move from coal-fired power stations to solar thermal was the most compatible and was very effective for their community. So compatible for the workers' skills and effective as an industrial base, both in terms of energy, but also in terms of the potential for newer industries like, you know, growing tomatoes in the desert, which they piloted and are now actually transporting those tomatoes and other vegetables to the cities. But the big problem there was, despite all of the planning, all of the feasibility, the governments, either at the state and federal level, didn't come to the table in time because the company actually decided, despite all its promises, that it would simply close the doors 3 years earlier, in some cases 6 years earlier, than they had actually indicated. So certainty is everything.
No, that's really interesting because, you know, I'm thinking here in the United States on the Navajo Nation, the Navajo Reservation, mainly in Arizona, is that economy is very dependent, for instance, on the coal industry. There are coal mines there. There's a very large coal-fired power plant there that the community relies on for many jobs. And the plant actually wants to close because it's getting undersold by natural gas, as it turns out. But the community, the tribe, is actually looking for ways to buy this plant and keep it active because there's no other way, from its point of view, to keep the jobs secure. And of course, the people there are living, they're struggling economically as many people are.
That requires a community renewal strategy that people can have confidence in. And you know, I mean, we all know that Arizona has lots of sun, probably has wind. And if you look at parallels to this, there's a company in Europe we work with called Enel. It's an Italian company. It has to close 23 power stations in the next 7 years. That's an exorbitant challenge. If you recall, Port Augusta was one, and we're talking 5 years and more. So, but Enel has an agreement with its unions in Italy. It has been working with our own Just Transition Centre. We actually partnered with some of the unions in the US in discussions at the California Summit because they're actually building wind in the US. And in that context, we want to make sure they're good jobs. So, of course, there's an element of the Just Transition that is, are your new ventures going to be respectful of rights and freedom of association and fair wages for the industry and so on? Now, Enel is committed to all of that, but it also goes a step further. In its own country or where it owns coal-fired power stations, it also has a commitment not to walk away from the community, to actually look at how they either build renewable energy in the community or, if it's not suitable, they look at other alternatives. That's the kind of Just Transition commitment we seek from every company, assisted with dialogue with the governments that are involved, whether it's local government, state government, federal governments, or all of those.
To what degree is retraining important in these situations? We struggle with this, as you probably know, in the United States, and I know other places must too. One issue in the United States is, first of all, many of the new jobs that might be created in a green transition will require different skills than what people have who are coal miners, for instance. And the second issue, particularly in the United States, is that a lot of these jobs, you know, let's say insulating millions of homes or installing solar panels on homes or things like that, that those are jobs that are going to be far away in some cases or farther away than where the workers in the old economy are working. So that's one issue. So one is the sort of geographic distance, and then the other issue is the training. You know, we have situations in which some of the new jobs actually aren't in energy at all, right, that are promising. They're in healthcare or they're in primary education. And a lot of, for a variety of reasons, a lot of people working in the coal industry, the pipeline industry, and these sorts of things, they don't immediately see themselves, right, as somebody who would be working in a hospital doing something completely different or teaching first graders or this. How do you recommend in your work advising unions around the world, how do you recommend that they understand the issue of retraining and mobility?
Well, it depends on which industry they're in, because every industry has to, in fact, make the transition. But I make the point that there will be still be workers in construction and energy and agriculture and services. You know, any industry we have today will exist in some form tomorrow. For coal mining, it's true that you have to look at the profile of the age of the community and plan to actually shut down the mine, but with that in mind. So yes, retraining for those who you can't retire with dignity, retraining is critical. And again, you have to look to the systems that exist. I know you have a particularly anti-union group of companies in the US, and that's distressing for us, because when unions actually are working with their companies, you can find solutions to these problems. In Denmark, the unions and the employers just created a fund which in fact allows for workers to be retrained with income and with redeployment as well as retraining support, so they don't feel like they're just left alone. And in that context, the trust is quite strong, because it's on average about 8 or 9 months. The maximum amount of time, not the average, is 8 or 9 months that workers are out of work and in training. And then, of course, in Sweden, they've just discovered that the retraining, a little like you just implied, requires more time, because it is either a different industry or it's upskilling. And so they're now looking at negotiating with the government to put in what would have been unemployment support for up to 12 months, plus the deferred, if you like, that the unions and the employers have bargained for, to make it possible for professional trades or other qualifications. So the solutions are there, but we have to want to have both the dialogue and the agreements that make it possible to gain people's trust so that you can actually see a future.
Well, now, I think you've put your finger on something really important, at least in U.S. politics, that I wanted to ask you about. It seems to me that a core piece of this just transition work involves, as you say, strong labor unions. And I would add countries that have a concept of a very strong social safety net, right? You mentioned Germany and Denmark and Australia and so on. And all of these, of course, have stronger safety nets compared to the United States, and a stronger concept, I think, just in the citizenry of unemployment insurance and healthcare and these kinds of things. To what degree is that important to a just transition? I guess another way I'm asking it is in the United States, do we have a chance? Because as you say, our labor movement is decimated here, and we have a very strong schism in the United States about the role of government in providing a strong social safety net. What would you recommend?
Well, I don't think your labor movement's decimated, by the way. I do think that you lack the strong
safety. Oh, good. Okay.
Well, you still have very strong collective agreements. Many of the areas we're talking about are actually unionized and do have regular dialogue with their employers. So when you look at, for example, an area where I know about, the New York unions are looking at what are the alternate jobs and how do they fund them? So there's a big interest in huge offshore wind projects down the coast. And we've brought together through our Just Transition Centre investors from Danish pension funds with the New York unions to actually try and build a base of not just a set of demands around new energy and good jobs, but also a partnership that could provide at least a base of the funding. And we can do more of that around the world because labour unions just don't organise and bargain for conditions. We build pension funds. We have $37 trillion of workers' capital invested in the global economy, and we want to put those partnerships together. What it takes is responsible employers to say, yes, it is our responsibility to make the transition. Now, we're not only talking about the harder end of this, which is coal mines and coal-fired power stations. We're actually also talking about how do you shift heavy industry? How do you actually shift the basis of, the overlap with climate and digitalization in services? What do you do about the work for construction workers? And, it's up to about 7 stars, I think, now, but 7-star buildings that require different skills. So you've got carbon neutrality and water positive outcomes from new buildings. How do you retrofit those 700,000 buildings that I heard the New York state governor say what they wanted to do? There's millions of jobs in that. And yes, it might require some retraining, but basically a construction worker is a construction worker, a manufacturing worker is a manufacturing worker. So the intersection of technology and skills is something we've dealt with for many, many years. But it does take political will. It takes a commitment from everybody. And in June, we'll actually be having a test of this around the world because we're having a global day of action in the last week of June where workers will invite their management to the table to talk to them about how they plan to climate-proof the workplace. And that means on zero carbon emissions plans, but it also means job security and good jobs in the transition. So there's lots we can do if people want to talk about climate-proofing workplaces with just transition measures, sustaining work businesses for the future. What's the plan to get there? It's not that hard.
Let's take a break. Now, listeners, if you like our conversations on CPR's Connect the Dots, you will love the conversations on our blog post, CPR Blog. That's where you'll find our own law and policy experts talking about everything from regulatory shenanigans in Washington, D.C., to the fight for safety in the workplace, to the relationship between, presidential emergency powers and climate change. So check us out. We're at www.progressivereform.org. When we come back, we'll talk about the Green New Deal. Ask you another question about U.S. politics, if I can, for a minute. You know that U.S. House Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey have introduced an outline of something they call the Green New Deal, which I'll stress is an outline, right? We're not quite sure everything that is going to be in it or that's going to result in legislation, but it really is a long, comprehensive list. You know, I'm looking at it, eliminate new carbon emissions in 10 years, modernize the electric grid, insulate millions of homes, revamp transportation, make our infrastructure climate resilient, and then improve worker safety, strengthen collective bargaining, improve education and healthcare, and so on. I'm not aware of an environmental plan in any country that's put so many things in a single cohesive plan like this. And in some ways, I'm very sympathetic, right? Because I believe, as you do, that if you're going to strip carbon out of a global economy that's been going on for more than 100 years, you have to be looking at every single facet of that arrangement, because we've built an entire world around that model. What I'm wondering is, do you think that this is, putting all of this in a single plan at this moment, do you think that that looks like overreach, or is that an idea whose time has come? What do you think?
Well, we have to have high ambition in every sector. So there are other countries. There's a high ambition group of countries within the climate negotiations, and they know that their contributions, the independent national contributions they make to the UNDP call for, in fact, UNFCCC call, sorry, the Paris Climate Agreement frame for ambition to get us to the point where we can save the planet for human beings, has to be across all those sectors. So this is, in fact, representative of that. Now, on the detail, I'm not in the US, I actually don't know the detail, but it, from what I understand, it's a resolution. It does hold ambition. But I would say if you're going to build trust around something that has the right set of ambitions, then you have to, again, come to the table, look at what it will mean in terms of positive outcomes for jobs through investment and the like, what retraining will be necessary, and where, if there are negatives, then how you actually build that just transition and the confidence with the unions that represent workers in those sectors. So talking to unions, talking to key community members, these things are critical to build the trust around such a visionary ambition. But it's where every country has to get to. If we need to be at net zero by 2050, you will hear all sorts of people say it's impossible. Well, if it's not possible, then saving the planet for humanity is impossible as well. So it has to be what we call mission possible. And even the research in heavy industry shows us we can get there, but we have to make sure that the trust, that high ambition is achieved through just transition and the trust that brings, then we will actually be confident of a future where we don't have to say anymore there are no jobs on a dead planet. We can say we are building living jobs on a sustainable planet.
Oh, I like your emphasis on trust. I was at a conference the other day. Somebody said that progress moves at the speed of trust. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, in the U.S., it seems to me, maybe other countries too, I think, you know, but not, since the 1970s, a lot of our policy looked to me kind of like an environmental overlay. In other words, you'd say, okay, we're going to keep doing what we do, we're going to shop a lot, drive as much as we want, eat as much as we want, and we're just not going to pollute as much, right? And I think with all of the limitations on emissions and things like that, and we sort of said, well, whatever else happens to get there is just going to happen, whether industries die out or people gracefully move on to other kinds of employment. And of course, that didn't work. In the U.S., we spent a lot of time, I think, in our policy thinking about aggregate social benefit as opposed to distributional benefit. You know, in the U.S., we have Mark Jacobson, who's a climate researcher at Stanford, has done a lot about the green transition and says, well, we could get on net 2 million new jobs in the United States at zero emission. But then he says, we'd create 6 million jobs and lose 4 million others. And we don't have much of a plan right in the U.S. for that kind of a transition. That sounds quite dramatic. I mean, a movement like that.
Well, the question is, first of all, on the jobs question, do you lose jobs or do you transition them by building and integrating skills and technology. And it depends on the industry, absolutely. But in most industry sectors, we don't have to lose jobs. We will, in fact, see some different skills required. We will see different technologies. And yes, you will lose some jobs. We don't make any bones about that. But if you don't have the plan to make sure that where jobs are lost in industries, and by the way, this isn't new. We've been losing jobs in industries with transition for many years. The difference is many of those transitions haven't been just, and this one has to be different, or the time scale we're in to save the planet will actually not be realized. So that makes trust and therefore just transition, he's absolutely right, fundamental. But on the question of how you get there, then I'm optimistic that if people just understand that working people have simple aspirations. We want good jobs, good wages. We want to be respected and rights, our rights respected. We want to have the kind of agreements that give us certainty, and that's fundamental from freedom of association and collective bargaining. And we want to ensure that our kids get a good education, that our health is supported, and that we can retire with dignity. Now, if they're the fundamentals, then what is it that we need to do to guarantee those? And first of all, you have to have a commitment to getting there. So everybody has to be on the same page. And I don't think anyone in the US doesn't want a decent future for their kids. But you're right about moving to two things that we've not dealt with effectively in many, many countries. One is redistribution, because inequality is out of control. It's now a global risk to the economy all of its own. Because even if people wanted to consume, when you don't have a capacity, then that's not going to happen. And secondly, it's resource productivity. Because if we actually move collectively to lower emissions, to take the pressure off the planetary boundaries that we're now, you know, actually at risk of going beyond, then you will have resource productivity. Companies will save money, whether it's on electricity or on carbon taxes or whatever, and you can redistribute that through good old-fashioned collective bargaining. But equally, if there are fair taxation systems and those who don't want to play are taxed on their carbon emissions, then you can redistribute that to people in need as well, or to people who need reskilling or need income support. So the solutions are possible. It's just a matter of a political will on behalf of governments and employers. But it's also about learning to trust each other to come up with the solutions that build stronger societies.
When you work with unions, do you find among the workers that they are at first skeptical about the promise of a just transition?
Yes, and they should be. They haven't seen a lot of it in the past. And, you know, we saw transitions in lots of industries, in manufacturing particularly, and it wasn't all that just. You saw whole communities lose their industries and, as you said earlier, people be forced to move on, dying towns. You can see that now around not just the US but many countries. That's got to change. We can't all live in the cities, and we're already leaping and towards 9 billion people on the planet. On the one hand, this is a great opportunity for jobs because we have to feed those people, we have to make sure that water is conserved, that we have construction for them, that production is actually going to meet the test of that demand. But on the other hand, we have to make sure that all of that is sustainable, or we won't get to a point where we've got an inhabitable planet that allows that. If you come from Australia like I do, it's burning, it's flooding, it's almost uninsurable. The world itself is becoming uninsurable, particularly if we keep tracking towards 3.5 degrees, because we're not pulling back on our current mode of production and consumption. But it is absolutely the case that in my country, at least, we were ahead of the game 10 years ago. I negotiated with the community and with the Labor government the first emissions trading scheme, and it was fair for everybody, had those redistributional impacts, started small for business but would build up in terms of their responsibility, created the dialogue structures, looked at energy efficiency authorities and so on. But we have a group of politicians who frankly are watching the destruction in my own country and are totally in denial. It's just not possible that we can keep electing people that refuse to understand that we are rendering the earth uninhabitable. We can have jobs, we can have communities that are great places to live, but we have to want to and we have to act.
Are you hopeful about our ability to transform in time to avoid the worst of climate change?
You know, I'm a total optimist, but I must say last week we were talking about, in fact, the economic narrative and the redistributional demands that we need to form our demands for the G20, the richest group of countries who will meet very soon in Tokyo or in Japan at least. And while I was listening to our economic experts, I was looking at the daily press on my iPad, you know, that terrible multi-skilling.
Yeah.
And there were two stories that actually frightened the hell out of me. If you want to be scared, read the IPCC reports. They're like a horror movie, but then read the one that they put out about 1.5 degrees last year. That's even worse. But I'm sitting there thinking, yes, we can do this. And we were, you know, I have very smart people who work for me who were showing me how you could calculate this, how you can have universal social protection, what the redistributional capacity was in various countries. And I said, you know, that's terrific. And I'm the eternal optimist and we will argue this. But today I learned that NASA had found a great big hole inside an iceberg, not just an ice block melting in Antarctica, but a huge hole inside it. So the Arctic melt, which will affect all the planet, is actually larger than anybody knew. And at the same time, fossil fuel companies that are on the ugly side of this equation, in this case ExxonMobil in particular, was actually gloating about how much investment it was going to put into fossil fuels in the next three decades. And I just thought, you know, people don't have a chance against the level of greed of those who should be responsible for transition. We don't want the oil companies to go out of business. We want them to use their skills and knowledge and the knowledge of their jobs to transition to sustainable, you know, renewable companies wherever that's possible. It's not always possible, but it is. And you can see small movements. Shell, now called Equinor, but Statoil out of Norway, they're not moving fast enough, but they are starting to look at how they invest more and more in renewables. We now need to say, how do you divest quickly, very quickly, in fossil fuels? But again, it's possible. And if we want the level of high ambition that will give us a habitable planet for our children and grandchildren, then we have to have just transition, because it's the trust that that builds that will get you the ambition.
Well said. I love that. Thank you very much, Sharon Barrow, for joining us on Connect the Dots.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show today. Make sure to tell your friends and colleagues about CPR's Connect the Dots. Visit our website and tell us what you'd like to hear about in the future, how we're doing. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Rob Virchik. Many thanks to our media intern, India Yarborough, the Center for Environmental Law at the University of New Orleans. This bouncy music comes from The Joy Drops. And our theme music, as always, comes courtesy of Lobo Loco. Take care.
You've been listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. We're a legal policy center working to build thriving communities on a resilient planet. Check us out and subscribe to our podcast by visiting our website at www.progressivereform.org. Thanks. See you there.